summer's almost over, but for the Montanan whose blood is yet to thin, I am so happy about this summer. It's been really enjoyable. No painfully hot stretches. We have just finished a sermon series this summer on the Barmer Declaration of Faith. And we did so with this intention, to lift up what the confession of true Christians was based on in the midst of real, powerful, and devastating evil. We did so wanting to strengthen ourselves in the midst of the own trials and struggles that we face. We cannot assume that we are immune to them. We certainly cannot assume that when the trials will come, we will stand firm on what is true. And the example of those who stood in the face of a machine that would run them down, yet who stood firm to the faith, is an example that we hold dear. And we should always be learning from those who have stood in tough places to bear witness to the one who laid down his life for them. We've spent the past six sermons on that in terms of just deep theology. And I want to do a Sunday today that is more devotional. That is to say that in the midst of what we believe, those statements about Jesus Christ, our commitment to his word, the belief that his church can and should stand firm, all those professions of faith hit the road when our hearts are brought in line with that confession. And so devotionally, I want to look at Psalm 37 today, and the reason I'm doing that is that on the front part of your bulletin are the lyrics to the hymn whose title made up the sermon series we've just completed, To the Winds Thy Fears. It's a hymn by Paul Gerhardt. And in the midst of this sermon series, I spoke about Dietrich Bonhoeffer a lot. Two things sustained Dietrich Bonhoeffer very deeply in his time in prison. One were the hymns of Paul Gerhardt. The second was the Psalms. Because even as he wrote his great works, he wrote the book Ethics, that is to say, what's a Christian ethical behavior like in the midst of a fallen world? That theological treatise couldn't have been written apart from his devotional connection to the Psalms, who upgraded him, that spoke to his situation. And the Psalms, if you get a chance to look through them, read through the Psalms devotionally, they describe real life. And that was so beautiful for Dietrich Bonhoeffer as he wrote his book, The Prayer Book of the Bible, the Psalms. This is the grounding in which he was able to center his faith in the midst of struggle. The hymn, To the Winds Thy Fears, is taken from Psalm 37. Hear the word of the Lord this morning. It's also in your bulletin. Do not fret because of those who are evil, or be envious of those who do wrong. For like the grass, they will soon wither. Like green plants, they will soon die away. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and enjoy safe pasture. Take delight in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him, and he will do this. He will make your righteous reward shine like the dawn, your vindication like the noonday sun. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when people succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. Refrain from anger and turn from wrath. Do not fret. It only leads to evil. For those who are evil will be destroyed, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. A little while and the wicked will be no more. Though you look for them, they will not be found. But the meek will inherit the land and enjoy peace and prosperity. This is a psalm of David, the king who himself went through a variety of struggles and hardships in his own life, who was pursued and had a bounty, as it were, on his head. And he's describing real life. How is it that we can put our faith in God Almighty, the one who we say is the everlasting, the one who we say is the one whose will and whose power can never be thwarted? How can we trust in that when it seems like all the raw material of our circumstances suggest otherwise? For David, it was the triumph of his enemies that was the deepest part of his struggle. And you know exactly what that means. The battles were being lost. The ground was being taken away. The pursuit of David, it seems, was getting stronger and stronger. And I'm sure as Dietrich Bonhoeffer sat in his cell, Tegel prison, and wrote his works on ethics and these great theological treatises that we still read today, that he also had to turn at times to the Psalms. And what he read in the Psalms was an exact description of what he was experiencing. Nazi evil had taken much ground. It had defeated many foes. And most disheartening of all is that its own ideology, its own ideology of Aryan supremacy and theology of the strong destroying the weak, even its own weak, that this would begin to infiltrate Christians who are supposed to stand and say, here is where I stand, I can do no other. In the great phrase of Martin Luther, who would not compromise his faith at the threat of being executed. He got away, but he still stood firm. And in the midst of that struggle, there are two things that usually present themselves to those of us who look at evil succeeding, who look at, it seems, evil winning the day to such an extent that we question whether or not the good is going to win in the end. We question whether or not those promises that we read in the Bible will come true, that God is really for us and not against us. The two things that crop up are anxiety, fretting, it says. It says it three times in this first 11 verses. Don't fret, don't fret, don't fret. Same thing happens routinely when angels of the Lord would appear. What? Do not be afraid, right? Paul would have to say it again and again. Do not be anxious. The anxiety that crops us up within our faith is something that can be devastating. What is anxiety? Anxiety is not, in terms of its initial attack upon us, it's itself not abnormal. We have kind of a fear that things are going to go wrong. It's a natural thing. A fear that crops up that says, oh boy, something evil might befall us today or in days to come. Or an anxiety that, you know, things may not get better for a long time to come. That kind of anxiety is cropping up itself within our own society. The economic fears, the anxiety that comes from, you know what, this just may not get better. Where's that going to leave me? The fear, I'm sure, of people living in these war-torn territories right now is a very real fear. It's a very understandable fear that at any day something can go wrong and we might be caught in the fire of that. The Bible doesn't say that we should never have anxiety or fear come upon us. It says that we need to recognize it for what it is and begin to let go of it. Because anxiety, when it is not checked, it has to be checked. It comes up. It's like a pawn on the chessboard. Anxiety moves its pawn two spots. It are coming. And where anxiety becomes problematic is when we're on the other side of the chessboard, we make no play. Or we make a retreat. Or we just take all the pieces off the board and say, I quit. Evil will always present itself towards us. It's not something that you can be out of the line of fire in. It will present itself in the most innocuous of temptations to the most obvious of evils. But it plays its move all the time. It puts its pieces on the board. Do you really believe what you say you believe? Do you really stand for who it is that you say you put your trust in? And routinely, the anxiety, the psalmist says, leads to things like anger. Wrath leads to evil. That is to say, the response to that play usually manifests itself in us in terms of its anger. And don't think for a minute that anger is a primary emotion for people who just can't control themselves. Right? We do this. We think, who is an angry person? Well, an angry person is someone who's, when things don't go their way, they're throwing pots and pans or they drive their car into a tree. No. Hitler's anger was deeply calculating. His hatred was just ingrained in ways that were shocking. Our anger, people can struggle with anger who don't even appear to be angry on the outside. Because their anger is directed towards circumstances that didn't go their way. Circumstances that didn't pan out the way they'd planned them to. And ultimately, the anxious life that leads to one who's kind of got this burning simmer of anger deep inside is one who's ultimately angry at God. God didn't come through for me. God hasn't shown himself to me in a way that we think he should. And when we begin to kind of allow that to come to fruit, the anger begins to take hold in ways that turn us into people we don't want to be at all. Anxiety, anger. And I think David describes these things because he's experiencing them. It's the great thing about the Bible. I hope you know this about the Bible. The Bible is written by people who were themselves fallen human beings. David, as we know, we call him the man after God's own heart, but also sinned greatly. Greatly. Every book in the Bible is written not by someone who could stand over us and say, you know what, if you were just like me, you'd listen to what I'm saying. David himself, we know, went into caves and had great fear. We know that he struggled deeply. He writes about this. He writes about in the earlier Psalms leading up to 37 about how he weeps and cries and has phenomenal fits of tears. And he also has these moments where he writes in the Psalms, which is great that he recorded them. I just hope you take them all out, God. Take my enemies out. Destroy them. It's an honest thing. It's not some pious person sitting in a cave saying, oh, hope we can all just get along. He's describing what he's really feeling. And I believe he's saying the same thing to us. I'm sure Dietrich felt the same way as well as he stood in that cell, very angry that people had abandoned it, very fearful for his own life, wondering if evil would win the day. And I'm sure he had to write to himself over and over again, cast to the winds thy fears. Hope and be undismayed. For God knows thy tears, knows thy, hears thy sighs and counts thy tears. God will lift up thy head. Something he had to say to himself over and over and over again. And so we ask the question, okay, In the midst of a person experiencing this, what are we called to do? That is, what can our play on the chessboard be in response to an action that to us should justify anxiety, should justify anger, should justify us either quitting or going after everything with kind of a vengeance? What's our play? Well, there are three initial plays. First was to trust in the Lord. How do you trust in someone? You trust their track record, right? That is to say, you can't trust someone based on a day of knowledge. They may seem trustworthy, they may speak the right things, but you cannot trust them unless you have references. You know, if you're looking to marry someone, you talk to their friends. You talk to their parents. If you've had a friend for a long time, you have a history with which to understand their lives, right? You've seen them in their good days and their bad days. Not just when they've put on a good show for you. You trust someone with the history. And the Jewish people, in the midst of the struggles that they faced over and over and over again in their land. I mean, they even made it to the promised land and lost it and rebuilt it and lost it. And it's been a history going on for centuries. Every year at their festivals, they had to remind themselves of what the Lord had already done. Remember the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Why do they have to be reminded of that? Because they forget. Because in the midst of the storm, it's as if the past doesn't matter anymore. And no, it matters greatly for who you can trust. And Christians are called to this kind of trust, that who it is that you're going to place your trust in. Well, we go back to the one who laid down his life for us. Again, you say, how can God love me? Well, let's look at the cross. How can God provide me? Let's look at the cross. How can God promise me that there will be life everlasting? How can he say that those who trust in the Lord will someday dwell in the land safely? Well, let's go back to the cross and the resurrection. There's a history there. We know that it was all leading up to him, and he pointed to those scriptures that pointed to him. He said, this is how it is that you trust in me. And you trust in me not because I've said it will be so, but because I've acted upon what I said would be so. It's not just words. Jesus is not just our guru who tells us nice things or wise things. He actually closed his mouth for one of the most pivotal points of his entire life, shut it up completely, and showed a love that the world cannot match. In the midst of great injustice, he laid down his life for us. We're to trust in him. We have to remember and remind ourselves of the history. But it also calls us, David says, to delight in him. This is where we get into trouble. This is not a theology that is talked about much, and it should be. It comes pretty strongly through one of our great writers of theology, Jonathan Edwards, who talked about this absolute need for us to desire God. There are a number of authors today who are taking up that mantle. Delight in him. So what do I mean by that? Let's say, I may have used this as an illustration before, but I'll use it again. Someone you love deeply, someone you're thinking about marrying, or maybe someone you've been married to, or a friend. Let's stick with maybe someone you're married to, okay? It's your anniversary that you're supposed to remember, and Jeff and Margie help remind you of that when it happens. And you show up on the front porch on the anniversary, the husband, you kind of want to surprise your wife, you've got flowers in your hands, you knock on the door, she opens it up, she goes, oh, how wonderful you've done this for me. And she looks at you and says, why did you do this? And you go, well, this is just my duty. thought it was the right thing to do. We call that something, right? It's the wrong answer. You can trust your spouse, But delight matters. Your kids can trust you, but delight matters. And it's not some kind of, you know, touchy-feely thing. It's to say that someone matters. You can have friends that you trust greatly, but you don't want to be around because they don't delight you. You don't delight in them. Their word could be good as gold. But you don't enjoy being around them. You want your kids to delight in you. You want to delight in your kids, and there's times when you don't want to be around them. But delight matters. Because you're not looking at someone for the sake of duty. You're actually looking at who they are. Their character. Their person. They have a name. They're not just son or daughter or wife or husband. They're someone you love deeply. And because of that delight, they feel honored. They're respected. And without delight, you cannot do the third thing, which is to commit. If you're thinking about getting married to someone and you trust someone but you don't delight in them, you will not commit to marrying them. You will not commit yourselves to the road ahead. If you're a parent, you won't stay in the game in the midst of struggles if you don't delight in your kids, even when they've hurt you terribly. David says you have to trust, but you also have to delight. And when you do that, when you delight in someone, you're then called to commit. That's the play on the board. You're making the move and saying, here's where I stand. I'm not going to be pushed back. I will not let anxiety make me stand still. I will not let that anxiety turn me into someone that I shouldn't be, letting anger just fly off the hook, anger that simmers deeply in resentment and passive aggression and hurtful comments and those kinds of things. The anxiety needs to go away because I'm committing myself to the Lord. I trust Him. I delight in Him. As I say, who He is, someone that I want to be like, someone I want to give my life to, and I'm going to commit it wholeheartedly here on out. And when you have those three things, say, I'm going to trust Him because I know His past. I'm delighting Him because He knows my name. He didn't just come and just in a blanket way says, I love everybody. He died for me. Because of that, I'm going to commit myself to Him. When those three things are in place, where does it leave us? It leaves us at a calm in the center of the storm, where we can step back and just stop. We can just be still and say, okay, I'm going to have a new perspective on the storm around me. I'm going to be still and see what He will work. I'm committed for the road ahead, but I have to press on, not knowing that it's all in my strength. It's in the Lord's and the Lord's alone. If you want to look at this psalm, I suppose, from maybe a navigational aspect, I love this kind of illustration of going for a sail on stormy seas. You think, it's a beautiful day. I'm going for a sail. My point is to get to the other side. Maybe Lake Michigan, huh? We're talking clipper sailing, okay? No California reservoir sailing. This is serious stuff. And you head out, and it seems good. It seems like I'm on the right path. I got the right ship. I've got the right captain. Everything seems to make sense to me. And then the storms begin to hit. And we begin to doubt whether we're on the right ship or we have the right captain, and we maybe want to turn back around because we thought it was smoother sailing where we'd taken off from, really not knowing where it's going to take us. Well, the person of faith will be different from the person who was evil and the person whose anxiety and anger has allowed them to become one like that, because they will be running around the deck saying the sky is falling. The person of faith can, as it were, transport themselves up a few thousand feet and see the whole landscape. Yeah, where we've come from had easy sailing, but you know what? That didn't test us very much. And where we're going actually has a nice harbor, and the storm that is over the ship will pass. But the one thing that can't be done is to bail now. Jesus himself was the calm at the center of the storm for his disciples, and he will be the calm at the center for us as well. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer, when he was imprisoned, he was within days of being released, and they found evidence of a conspiracy in which he was involved. They rounded him up with about six other people and moved him to a few other places, and the last words that he spoke to one of his friends as the, actually, here's the last hour of his life. They came in the upper room of a prison and says, "Dietrich, you have 1 hour." In that hour, he led his comrades there in worship, and then the people came up the stairs and said, "Dietrich, it's time to go." When he turned to his friends, he says, with a smile on his face, "For me, this is the end. But it's also the beginning of life. Trust in the Lord. Delight yourself in the Lord. Commit your life to the Lord. And be still." Only one with that trust could have said that at that moment. Do not be anxious. Give to the winds your fears. Let's pray. Lord, we